to the second case of the day.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, in the matter of Andrea Myers. Mr. Hamilton?
May it please the court, opposing counsel. The issue that has never really been addressed by the lower courts, which is the key to this issue, is this whole concept of how this post-petition income tax withholding can be part of the bankruptcy estate. That's the issue that decides this case. And I submit that there's no way post-petition income tax withholding, which is purely discretionary by the debtor, can become a part of the bankruptcy estate and can become a claim by the trustee.
You know, I found it very odd that your argument depends on comparing the pre-petition amount of withholding for a particular tax year with the full amount of the taxes due for that year. And I understand your argument is that for different purposes under the tax code, sometimes people can make short year elections, but that doesn't answer my concern that you're really not comparing like to like.
That's the troublesome element of the issue, which I think bothered the lower courts, was that the impact here seems to be that the entire tax liability is being paid by the pre-petition income tax withholding.
Well, and by, therefore, the unsecured creditors who are picking up, as it were, the part of the tax that would otherwise be paid by the debtor.
There seems to be at least 5 points why that result, that this pre-petition income tax withholding should could be compared to the tax, is correct. First one is that the
I'm sorry, before you get to your 5 points, are you agreeing that the entire tax liability is being covered by the pre-petition withholdings then? That you're shifting post-tax liability to the pre-petition period? I'm sorry, post-petition liability?
That's not the point I'm conceding.
But that's what you're doing. That's what you wanted to happen, right? You wanted to take the pre-petition withholding and subtract the entire amount of the tax against it. That's crucial to the math that you used. And I'm saying that I have some problem with that.
That's a result dictated by the bankruptcy code.
I don't see where it is, in fact, dictated by the bankruptcy code.
There's the 5 points that I raise on that specific point. The first point. The post-petition, the debtor has no duty to the bankruptcy estate to make any income tax withholding whatsoever. The debtor cannot add post-petition assets to the bankruptcy estate by making income tax withholding, by making an estimated tax payment.
But you're looking at withholding instead of the fundamental fact that post-petition, the debtor owes taxes. The debtor has a tax obligation to both the federal government, whatever the relevant state, if they happen to have an income tax, as Missouri does. So the question, in a sense, is can the debtor, right before filing for bankruptcy, either make a large estimated tax payment or in some other way shield income from the creditors by prepaying taxes?
But if a debtor makes a payment pre-petition, the IRS has got a hold of that money. It's going to be applied to the taxes. That becomes relevant to the issue of any payments made before the bankruptcy petition.
But that's what withholding is. Withholding is an advance payment, just the same as estimated taxes.
I mean, that issue is not squarely something addressed in our briefs, but I know that there are cases that have discussed what happens when you make a big payment towards your taxes before you file the bankruptcy, and the IRS gets to keep that money. And if there's anything left, then we have an issue about where is it going to go. Does it go to the bankruptcy estate, or does it go back to the debtor? And the key is, when were these payments made? Were they made pre-petition? In which case, it's based on the actions and the conduct of the debtor, and the bankruptcy estate has an interest in it because there's a legal and an equitable interest in property, or is it something that takes place post-petition?
Why isn't the key when the tax liability accrues, pre-petition or post-petition?
Well, the tax liability will not be known until the end of the year in the absence of an election to split the tax year into two components.
But that shouldn't affect anything. You can still determine on the pro rata basis what's due before and what's due post-petition.
I mean, I suppose it's theoretically possible to figure out how much tax would be due as of the date of the bankruptcy filing and compare that to pre-petition income tax withholding. I suppose that could be done, but conceptually, from a technical standpoint.
Of course it could be done. And in some cases, that would be very significant. And I think that's what this Donald case that you rely on so heavily recognizes. In other cases, when you have a taxpayer like Ms. Myers, with linear functions of income, linear functions of withholding, linear functions of everything else for the most part, just this straight pro rata approach seems to make sense. I don't think anybody's saying you always have to do pro rata by days, but we don't have, for example, a home contractor who does all of his business during the months of April through, you know, October, and then that's when he's earning his income, and he really gets no income at all during the slow months of the year. There you might allocate when did the tax liability accrue, even though, of course, it's only due at the end of the year. But this is just a person who has W-2, pretty much the same income.
Well, the problem with the pro rata days method isn't that we should just completely throw it out and say it never works, but it should not be used.
Pretty well here. How much do you think your client was compelled to contribute to the bankruptcy estate by the use of this pro rata by days system? In other words, I take it your point is that using this pro rata methodology means that money that she should have been able to keep was instead attributed to the bank, was pulled back into the bankruptcy estate by the trustee. How much?
The trustee's claim, I believe, is about $900.
No, that's the amount of. But you're saying that's too much. I know I'm probably not going to be clear because I don't like your system that leads to this $300 sum figure that you came up with. You seem to be thinking that by applying this 73.42% pro rata number, that maybe there was some money that she should have been able to keep if we really allocated the year perfectly, that she didn't keep.
Not completely sure I follow the question, Your Honor. I'd be happy to address it by you.
Using your math, and that's the problem, this is apples and oranges. Using your math, you think she's paying $600 or so too much.
Correct.
Right. And I'm concerned, I guess, I was thinking, in one hypothetical, according to you, 73.42% allocates too much to the pre-petition share of the withholding. And maybe you think it should have been 70% or something. In another hypothetical, the 73.42% allocates too little to the pre-petition withholding, and it really should have been 80%. Right? So
those exact percentages, I mean, the parties go at length about making comparisons about percentages here and percentages there. But merely all it does is illustrate the problem, which is that this post-petition income tax withholding, which is entirely within debtor's control, that's indisputable, that's an irrefutable point. If Andrea Myers had stopped making her post-petition income tax withholding on the date of the bankruptcy petition, there would have been no tax refund
period. So I'm saying you are essentially saying that the dollars attributable to her post-petition withholding should have been hers. So that's just that part of the year, the other 25-odd percent of the year. And I don't see why the trustee's system doesn't leave those dollars. Now, of course, some of them had to go to paying her taxes, but that's what Judge St. Eve was saying. She accrued tax liability after the petition, too. Now, whether she withheld them or not, or whether she paid the taxes because her great aunt gave her a gift, or whether she paid the taxes because she found some other money, no one cares. The IRS certainly doesn't care where the money comes from as long as you pay for it.
The trustee's formula took too much of that post-petition income tax withholding by applying that arbitrary 73.42%.
But it wasn't arbitrary. It was based on the percentage of pre-petition days. If it were arbitrary, I would agree with you. But how is it arbitrary when they said she filed her petition on this day, there are 365 days out of the year, this day is X percentage, 73.42% of days of a 365-day year. How is that arbitrary? I don't understand.
It's not arbitrary up to that point, but the problem is it makes an illegal attachment of the post-petition income tax withholding by the time you've run all these numbers. And it's a difference of about
$600. But when it takes the withholdings for the entire year and applies that 73.4% percentage to the withholdings and attributes that to pre-petition because that's the exact number of pre-petition days, how is that arbitrary?
Well, that's contrary to my understanding of the trustee's argument because they just took the grand total of the refund at the end of the year and said we're going to take 73% because that's how many days during the year. It wasn't so much this comparison of 73-point-something percent of pre-petition income tax withholding with 27% of post-petition income tax withholding. It's arbitrary in that the refund was, let's say it's $2,500. The trustee is saying give me 75% just because that's the day that they filed. It couldn't be any more arbitrary. The problem with the post-petition income tax withholding is it's entirely within the debtor's control to whether to make those payments. So if my position is correct and the court reverses, what's going to happen is the debtor's going to continue to do their post-petition income tax withholding like they always do. If the court says, no, I think this post-petition, this pro-rata by days method is okay, every client I have, I'm going to tell them, stop your post-petition income tax withholding right now as of the day of the filing of the bankruptcy. Nobody can stop them. And the point is, here we have a debtor who has made a voluntary act to make payments.
And in that case, under the methodology I think that the trustee is arguing for, you would see that all of the withholding was pre-petition. It thus all goes back to the bankruptcy estate. You know, you'd still do the pro rata thing, but you would look more particularly at what got prepaid. I really want to say, again, withholding is just a form of prepayment of taxes. The IRS likes to get its money up front. There's a whole set of rules about withholding. And I'm not sure your clients would be any better off with that recommendation on your part.
In this case, if Andrea Myers had stopped her income tax withholding, then at the end of the year, she would have had no excess income tax withholdings. There would have been no refund. She would have paid nothing.
She wouldn't. That's not correct, because she'd still be responsible for paying to the IRS the post-petition taxes.
Right.
She may not have paid them in advance, but she'd still have to pay something.
She would still have to pay the IRS, but then she would definitely have kept more money in her pocket relative to the taxes that she would have had to pay.
But that's not what happened here. Even assuming what you said is correct, that's not what happened here.
That's not what happened. It didn't happen because she made a voluntary decision on her own behalf to pay the post-petition income tax withholding. No one else can make her do that. The trustee cannot say, debtor, you must continue to withhold income tax. The court cannot say, debtor, you must continue to withhold income tax. It's
most
a purely voluntary
payment.
Most
employers have an obligation to withhold, just by the way. Household employers don't have to withhold, but most ordinary employers are required by the IRS to withhold. You can ask for extra withholding. And there's a limit on how many exemptions you can take. If you're a single person, you can take one exemption. You can take zero. But, in fact, it's required to withhold.
But the debtor can specify no withholding on their income.
No, that's what I'm telling you. You're wrong about that. Unless you're a household employer. I mean, there's some types of employers who have that option. But, you know, if you're Boeing, you don't have that option. You have to withhold.
In the Donald case, the judge makes a point of saying that the debtor is entirely in control of post-petition income tax withholding. I believe that is the tax law. Is that the debtor can reduce their income tax withholding to zero. And the tax is what it is at the end of the year. And whatever has been applied to that is the pre-petition income tax withholding compared to the tax. So that's what is defined. That's how you determine the amount that's a pre-petition asset. And it's the same thing as if the debtor makes an estimated tax payment post-petition.
Well, I don't want to get into a big tax debate with you about this, but...
And it may be that in some of these hypotheticals you've given that the pro rata method doesn't work. But the question is, why doesn't it work here? Aren't you just shifting the tax burden to the creditors?
It doesn't shift the tax burden to the creditors because the bankruptcy code limits the prepetition creditors to that which is an asset of the bankruptcy estate. And it's this pre-petition income tax withholding.
But if the bankruptcy estate is paying 100% of the taxes for the year, then the bankruptcy estate, as it does with your math, the bankruptcy estate is covering the taxes attributable to the person's earnings for the post-petition period.
But the bankruptcy estate hasn't paid anything here. because...
Yes, it has. If it doesn't get the money back, if this recapture that the trustee is trying to effectuate doesn't happen, then it is, in effect.
The debtor is paid the pre-petition income tax withholding, and the IRS has collected. The bankruptcy estate hasn't paid anything.
It's a matter of characterization, I think.
I mean, if the bankruptcy estate had to take assets and apply that and pay tax debt, we'd have a different animal altogether. But this is the debtor's pre-petition income tax withholding. The debtor has paid it, not the bankruptcy estate. It's getting applied to the tax liability, the total tax liability for the whole year. And the reason for that is because you can't take the post-petition income tax withholding and make it an asset of the bankruptcy estate. It's a violation of Section 541. I exceeded my time.
Ms. Lopino?
Yes. Good morning, Your Honors. The court has hit on the very key issue that has troubled the trustee using the debtor's allocation method. It's that the pre-petition tax withholdings are being used to pay the post-petition tax liabilities. Now, one thing that I would like to do is to point out to the court how the interplay of these current year tax obligations works in bankruptcy code. Under Section 502A, or 502B, a claim against a bankruptcy estate has to be capable of being valued as of the petition date. There has to be an existing claim as of the petition date. Post-petition tax liabilities become due for the current year after the debtor files the bankruptcy case, just by nature of the way the tax code works. So what will happen is, in the case of this debtor, you file bankruptcy in September of 2007. Your tax liability comes due December 31st of 2007, and then you file your return by the following April.
So it can be difficult, though, to allocate tax liabilities for partial years because some deductions don't prorate so easily. Some tax credits don't prorate so easily.
That is true, Your Honor, and that is one reason why the pro rata by days allocation method is a very efficient way to do this, particularly in an instance like the case before the court today, where the debtor accumulated earnings and withholdings at a relatively constant rate throughout the entire tax year. The trustee does not make any assertion that in a situation such as Donnell, where there wasn't the regular accumulation of these withholdings and of earnings, that the pro rata by days method would work, because it doesn't work in those types of situations. However, in a situation like this, where the debtor basically accumulated her income remained the same, both pre and post-petition, her withholdings didn't change, this method works.
Let me ask you a couple of procedural questions. The trustee in this case came forward with the pro rata by days numbers. And in a sense, that was the trustee's first move to satisfy whatever her burden of proof was, whether you think it's by a preponderance or whether you think it's by clear and convincing evidence. And so then the next question is, you know, what do you envision happening next? Was it up to the debtor to say that this wasn't one of those cases that pro rata by days works with? Because as I understand it, the burden in the final analysis remains with the trustee.
That is correct, Your Honor. The burden of proof does remain with the trustee. This pro rata by days method of allocation is commonly accepted within the bankruptcy courts. I think that in the briefs we have presented enough case law out there where the courts have acknowledged that it's a very common method of allocation.
But it's a little bit imprecise, right? So I guess in the case of this debtor, to the extent there were deviations, there might have been some pay periods in which she had more overtime and maybe withholding wasn't handled the same way for overtime. There are deviations. So do we need to call for a methodology that's a tighter fit with what's really happening pre-petition and post-petition?
I think not, Your Honor. In cases like this where nothing changes really pre- and post-petition, and the reason why is because for most of these types of cases, when you compare the additional incremental benefit to the estate by doing a more precise calculation, and then you look at the impact on the creditors of the estate, what would happen, for example, in this case, I believe the difference that Your Honor was looking for before was approximately $600, give or take a little bit. The trustee was at about $971, right, and the debtor was at $300. So in this case, when you look at the amount of unsecured claims who would be the benefit of that incremental difference and spread it out among those creditors, it's a relatively nominal amount. And so I think that the efficiency of the pro rata by days method would outweigh the additional benefit to the estate from a more detailed and exhaustive analysis, especially here when nothing really changed.
Is that because the estate's paying the trustee, or what?
Well, when you spread out $600 additional assets into the estate among $43,000 worth of claims, it's a relatively small amount, is what I'm trying to get at, Your Honor. And so there's, and when you look at the number of cases out there, for many, many debtors in a Chapter 7 case, the tax refund is probably one of the biggest sources of recovery for the estate because it's typically unencumbered.
So are you arguing that the pro rata method should always apply, or that there should be a presumption that it applies and there might be cases where there's an exception?
I would argue, no, it doesn't apply in all cases because things change. And for example, if the debtors don't have, if they lose their job post-petition, or if they had lost their job pre-petition and then had post-petition earnings, then I don't think it works in that situation for the reasons that opposing counsel has set forth. But in these cases, I think it works very well. And I think that, yes, to some extent, there probably is a presumption that it works. I think in this case that the trustees set forth, it's a very simple method that doesn't require a whole lot of evidentiary support to it other than debtor got a tax refund, this is the petition date, this is what the number is.
So you would see a burden of production then on the debtor to come forward and explain why in the particular circumstances, whether, as you say, it's the lost job or it's the self-employed person or something.
Yes, I certainly would say that, Your Honor. And that's what the bankruptcy court had found in this case. I think also in helping the court decide the issue of the post-petition taxes being borne by the estate, one of the other sections of the code that would be helpful would be to look at 507A8, which is the priority statute, because the priority statute is very clear that claims for taxes have to occur for tax years that ended prior to the petition date. And so when you've got an ongoing tax liability for the year of filing, that would not fall within the priority claims. And it just doesn't make sense that Congress would carve out those claims and not intend that the taxes for the current year be a post-petition liability. Well, Your Honors, we would ask that the court affirm the bankruptcy court's decision. We believe that the pro rata by days method is an appropriate method to use, particularly in these situations where there isn't any change in the rate of withholdings or tax deposits during the year. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Is there any time left? Your time expired, Mr. Hamilton, but you may have a minute if you wish.
Thank you, Your Honor. I will close with a quote from this Donaldson case, which I think answers the question. Wage withholding made post-petition cannot be a valid source of the claim by the bankruptcy estate because the monies in question were withheld from post-petition earnings, which themselves would not be property of the estate in a Chapter 7 case. That's the key to the whole issue. If this premise is valid, and I submit that it is, this court should reverse. Thank you.
Thank you, Hamilton. Thank you, Mr. Hamilton. The case is taken under advisement, and the court will proceed.